This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We know that vaccinations work. They prevent horrible diseases. They have saved millions of lives. And we know that a vaccine does not cause autism. That is a fact. But a growing number of parents are opting out of vaccinations for their children. And that's causing a public health problem. So we're going to be talking about the magnitude of that problem today. What is the trend? What is behind that? What needs to be done to get more children vaccinated for the sake of public health? We invite you into our conversation today. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. And you can tweet at us at @tprsource. Our guest this afternoon, we're joined by Emily Royale. She is the data director for the Rivard Report, and she did a deep dive into where we're not getting vaccinated here in San Antonio and Bexar County. Dr. Junda Wu is the medical director for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District, and Allison Winneke is on the line. She's the president and CEO of the Immunization Partnership, and it's great to have all of y'all with us this afternoon. Emily, tell me about what you found looking at the numbers.
Sure, David. So here's the numbers for you, and these come from data from the Texas Department of State Health Services, specifically their annual report of immunization status that they release every year. It's clear from these reports that the percentage of students claiming non-medical exemptions, so those based on religious or personal beliefs, is on the rise in Bexar County. The percent of all students in Bexar County that filed these exemptions increased from about 0.3% to 0.8% since 2012. Among kindergarten students, non-medical exemptions in our county increased by 136% for polio, 169% for chickenpox, and 153% for tetanus since 2010. If you don't have enough numbers, here's a few more. About more than 1.5% of kindergarten students in Texas were not vaccinated last year. This is due, again, to religious or personal beliefs in citing these exemptions. And that comes out to over 56,000 non-medical exemptions that were claimed in Texas just last year.
Dr. Junda Wu, if we look at the a longer time period, say like 15 years or so, we see a great number of increase in vaccinations in Bexar County, an improvement in getting vaccinations out there. But are you alarmed by what you're seeing with this reverse in that trend?
We're fairly steady. I mean, when you look at the margin of error with our vaccination rate for the major what we call the combined series, at about 69% in 2016 in Bexar County. So we actually have a ways to go still. The Healthy People 2020 goal is 80%. And it's a problem because we know that in states, in communities, in schools where there are larger numbers of people who are not vaccinated, that we see more vaccine-preventable diseases, and sometimes those can be serious.
Particularly measles?
Measles is very contagious, and so, yes, measles is a problem. But, you know, in Texas, just in the last year, in Ellis County, measles, at the Dallas Cheerleading Championship in March of this year, mumps, at Texas State University in May of this year, mumps. So, yes, we're seeing diseases that we once had hope of eradicating.
And Allison Winneke, the president and CEO of the Immunization Partnership, what are you seeing?
Well, the alarming trend that we've continued to see year over year since 2003 is the exponential growth in these non-medical exemptions. And the issue with these non-medical exemptions is that we're seeing them cluster in communities. And in those clustering areas, that means that the herd immunity or the community immunity, the high level of protection that is needed to make sure that everyone in the community is safe from vaccine-preventable diseases, in those clustering communities of exemptions, we are not hitting those extremely high rates. And that puts the community at risk. And as you just heard, we see that in outbreaks. And we also can see those clustering areas are matching up with some of the data that you heard about earlier with the Department of State Health Services exemption data in school districts. And in especially in Bexar County, we're worried about the increasing number of folks opting out for non-medical reasons because it puts not only their children at risk, but the community as well at risk.
So, Emily Royal, with your data, you're able to see that there are clusters in Bexar County. People essentially self-select not to vaccinate their children based upon where they get their information from. And what are you finding?
Sure. So in this story, that's part of our Terabyte series on the Rivard Report, we mapped out actually the locations of schools in Bexar County. And when you hover over those schools, you can see the percentage of students that are vaccinated against, you know, things like tetanus, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, measles, et cetera. And we did find 11 schools. You know, we just picked one vaccine. There's so many to look at, but we looked at polio. And we did find 11 schools in Bexar County that have a 5% or greater percentage of kindergarten students that are not vaccinated against polio. And as Allison mentioned, you know, there is a threshold for what is a safe number of students to be vaccinated before you might have some issues with the spread of disease. And in our interview with her, she told us that that threshold, the safe threshold for vaccination, is typically above 90%. So for those schools that we found, which you can find in the article, that is a concern and an issue.
Do other parents know that they are sending their child to a school? And these are typically like charter schools?
Some of them are. Some of them are charter schools. Some of them are public schools. The majority of those that do have this 5% or greater are charter schools.
Do parents know that, or should there be, is there a level of disclosure that they are sending their child into a classroom where half of the children have not been vaccinated?
I don't know. That's something that maybe Allison might be able to speak to with her experience in schools.
Allison?
Yeah, and so that is a wonderful question. So the answer to your question is no. Parents would not know within their classroom or even the school building where their child goes to what the exemption rates are. The state, those numbers are available and reported to the state, but the state only makes public and available at an ISD, the independent school district level. And so for large school districts, particularly, you know, in San Antonio and other major cities where there may be hundreds of schools, different elementary, high school, and so forth, we only get one giant aggregated number. And so a parent would really have no idea at the particular school their child goes what the rate is. And that's something that we have advocated for years, is more data transparency so that parents are able to make informed decisions about the safety of their children. Because sometimes just having the school district number is really too large, and that's just not specific enough that parents can make informed decisions about where their child would go.
And I don't know if that would actually discourage or encourage people to get vaccinations if they found out that many of their friends and neighbors decided not to get vaccinated. That's something else we can discuss later on. Parents, how easy or difficult has it been for you to get your child vaccinated in time for the new school year? Have you considered getting one of these opting out forms and checking off, I don't want to get vaccinated? Why? What was your reasoning? Do you think that you're protecting your child, or could you be making your child more vulnerable? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this one-minute break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Back to school time, and for many that means roll up the sleeve and get those vaccinations so you can get back into the classroom. But some parents say, no, here's a form. We can fill it out. We can check off the box saying that I have a philosophical or a religious objection to getting the vaccines, and therefore we don't got to get them. And we send our child to school, and they sit right next to your kid, and they could get a deadly disease. And will that pass on to the next child? Let me ask that question to Dr. Junda Wu. She's the medical director for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. If I get my child vaccinated. They've got the MMR. They got everything. They're ready to take on, you know, they're vaccinated. So what difference does it make that the kid next to them didn't?
Well, you heard Emily talk about herd immunity, so that protects the whole community, but also none of our vaccines are perfect as much as we would like them to be. The measles one is very effective, the tetanus one is less so. We live in a global world now, so it's not just about where your own kid goes, but that we have whooping cough and measles and mumps that are still very common in other countries that we now find our kids here exposed to. So you still do need to get vaccinated. And even if you're vaccinated, having other kids around you who are not vaccinated still leaves you vulnerable.
And Allison Winneke, why are parents deciding to opt out?
Well, one major thing that we have observed over the years is that there have been a lot of misinformation spread around about immunizations and negative reactions to immunizations. A lot of that stems from a discredited article that was published back in 1999 by a former doctor in the UK who fraudulently linked the MMR vaccine with autism. And then it ended up that the study was fraudulent. He lost his medical license. But that link sort of perpetrated, and there were a lot of fears because there wasn't necessarily at that time and even today a direct understanding of the cause of something that's very scary like autism. And vaccines were kind of picked a little bit as a scapegoat. And I will add that vaccines are one of the top 10 public health achievements in the last century, and they're because they've saved so many lives and prevented so many diseases, but they're also a victim of their own success. So a lot of times people today, they don't see polio. They don't see, you know, cases of measles and mumps regularly, and so they are not as properly afraid of some of the consequences of catching those things because we've done such a good job. But now, because we're seeing so many folks decline to be vaccinated, we are worried about slipping back into a time when those kind of diseases do spread more easily and rapidly. And that's very dangerous and deadly.
All right, just go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Jennifer is on the line. Jennifer, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The reason why I called is, first, I'm a nurse. I have three kids, and it has never even crossed my mind to not vaccinate according to my doctor's schedule. So that has led me to question the parental research that's going on, and I wanted to know, first of all, if your guests have done any research on the parent level of education and how that correlates with vaccine refusal rates, as well as the provider's perception of the effectiveness of vaccines. Some of my patients have told me that other providers have said they would not accept or recommend this vaccine for their own child, and it's okay. They're okay with alternative schedules. So I'm interested to hear their feedback.
All right, Jennifer, you bring up two good points. We'll talk about the alternative schedule, but I want to get to the question that you brought up about the education level, even income level, of a lot of people who decide to opt out of getting their vaccinations. And Allison Winneke with the Immunization Partnership, can you kind of help us with that?
Sure, absolutely. And so it's actually interesting that a lot of data shows that in some areas where we do see high clustering of vaccine refusal, they're actually in zip codes that are considered affluent by income level and also have higher education levels. So both parents, you know, high school graduates, probably college graduates, and sometimes even advanced degrees. And, you know, historically, we have seen that trend, and kind of the ability to understand a little bit about research but not necessarily have a medical background. And so they may misunderstand some medical information out there, but they also feel more confident challenging physician and healthcare provider recommendations. And so that is historically a trend that we have seen, but also I will add that there really is now with Facebook and Google and the internet, there's a real democratization of information and misinformation sharing. And so we are seeing, you know, among different income disparate income levels and education levels, that information, misinformation being spread. And so it's no longer necessarily an issue of sort of the affluent suburban, parent who may send their child to private schools. We're seeing those kind of issues starting to spread into what before in sort of lower income areas and folks that were on CHIP and Medicaid and things like that who had historically had higher immunization rates.
And so Emily Royal?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I think, something that's an important part of the backdrop to this story, which is that in 2003, the Texas state legislature did expand what constitutes as a non-medical exemption beyond just a religious belief, but to include a personal belief or a philosophical belief that is not based on a religious affiliation. And so the ease with which people can claim those exemptions now might also be an incentive for some parents to take that more convenient route than to go through the trouble of taking the kids to the doctor and getting them vaccinated on the appropriate schedules.
Dr. Wu, you wanted to add to that?
Well, I think it's important in a time when a lot of issues are polarized to not let vaccines fall into that bipolar view of the world.
Don't make it red versus blue.
Don't, because we know, for instance, from a recent study that 86% of Republicans actually are very supportive of vaccination. And if we let it be red versus blue, then we're going to lose this.
Right, exactly. So therefore, people will use tribalism, cognitive, to try and figure out where do I stand on this. People need to pay attention to the science and not according to their political banners.
Yes.
Okay, and so, but I want to bring up what the caller had about the alternative schedule. And there are many people who say, I'm not anti-vaxxer, but I think that the doctors are giving us too many vaccines all at once, and I want them spread out. And they talk about recommending a alternative schedule for vaccinations. And what is wrong with that, Dr. Wu?
There are more vaccines now because our science has progressed, so we have more. And I know it's painful to see your little kid be, it feels like a pincushion, but the schedule was developed for maximum immunity and also for there's a certain level of convenience to do to do these at 0 months, 2 months, 6 months.
Because many parents don't have the ability to make multiple trips to the pediatrician.
Yeah.
So you want to take advantage of when they're there, and also you want to deliver the vaccines at a time when the child is the most vulnerable to becoming infected.
Right. So there are large committees of people who think about this a lot more than I have who've come up with that schedule. That's what we recommend. I know a lot of times just as a doctor, part of talking to your patient, we're not directive the way we used to be. There's some bargaining. So if the bargaining will help get the child get all the vaccinations, I do understand why some pediatricians do that.
And Allison Winicky at the Immunization Partnership, what is your view of an alternative schedule, a strain from the CDC's schedule?
Well, it actually can be quite dangerous. I mean, there is, as you heard Dr. Wu mention, sort of the bargaining. It is better to have children immunized than non-immunized. But there is a reason that the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices put together these recommendations is because these are the immunizations at these particular ages for these particular risk factors that are the most effective to protect the child. And deviating from those recommendations, which are continually updated, they update them every year to make sure they are up on the most recent science, and they continually research things. Deviating from those means that they are not following the best medical practices and may leave their child at risk.
Let's go back to the phones with Joe. And Joe, welcome to The Source, sir. You're on the air.
Yes, I was just wanting to comment that I think.
All right, we're cutting out there, but I can see from my notes from my producer is that Joe is talking about celebrities affecting public perception. And so there have been a number of high-profile individuals who've come out and said, Jenny McCarthy is one of them. She's like a former Playboy model or something, and she's been very successful using emotional arguments, trying to get people to doubt the effectiveness of vaccination. So Allison Winicky, there have been celebrities saying also get vaccinated too.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, celebrities play a part in our public discourse. But I think that, you know, the most important people to listen to when we're talking about our healthcare decisions are our primary care doctors, our pediatricians, our healthcare professionals, because they have they're scientists, they are medical professionals, they have the best information, and they care too about the health of your child as well as your family. And they have an interest in making sure that you're healthy, your child's healthy, our community is healthy, and to give you the best advice. And so I personally like to take my medical advice from medical professionals and not necessarily celebrities, although we obviously recognize that folks who have a pulpit and a Twitter account also get a lot of media attention as well.
Yeah, and also celebrities are very good at using the media to make a point, whereas scientists, not so much. So like Dr. Wu, scientists use things like scientific uncertainty when they communicate these things, and it doesn't work very well.
It doesn't. I think there are a couple of things. There's the language, like you talked about. I mean, when you're talking about autism, really what we're trying to make is a point that association is not causation, which, you know, there's somebody who has a whole website about how, you know, taking examples of two statistics that don't really match up but that are associated, like per capita, how many people eat cheese, how much cheese people eat, and how that's tied to, you know, strangulation in bed sheets. I mean, just because the numbers go up and down at the same rate doesn't mean that they're one is the cause of the other. But recognizing that that's too technical, a good default is talk to your pediatrician. We know people trust their pediatricians, and that's probably the best place for these conversations.
But when we talk about scientific uncertainty, you say we have to put these caveats on things. There is no evidence that leads us to believe that there is a connection between autism and vaccinations. And then some people are going to hear that and say, like a Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber, so you're telling me there's a chance. And but it's like, well, I have pretty much certainty that the sun is going to rise tomorrow, even though it has for millions of years, but I can't tell you with absolute certainty that it's going to happen again tomorrow, because we don't know for sure. Something could happen and we could be knocked out of orbit, and we wouldn't, you know. With scientific uncertainty is a strange thing, and it's hard to put that into the public vernacular.
Jim Carrey is on the list of anti-vaccine celebrities, by the way, David.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
There are definitely scientific conversations where that's more relevant. I think with vaccines, that doesn't come up as much. With vaccines, I'm comfortable saying they're safe, they work. And
there's overwhelming evidence that supports that.
Overwhelming evidence. But it's normal to be worried because there's so much out there in the media. So
I think we should address that. We're going to try to address that in a respectful, honorable way when we come back from the break and help people make better decisions. All right. So the number to call in is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. We're talking about vaccinations, going back to school, and why you ought to get them. This is The Source. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about back-to-school vaccinations and why there's a trend with parents opting out. The state of Texas makes it easy for parents to sign a form, and they can opt out for either for medical, religious, or philosophical reasons. But when they do that, and there's a growing trend towards that, we're creating a hole in our herd immunity, especially in certain clusters, certain schools where this seems to be more popular healthier than others, where children are put at risk. What kind of questions do you have or comments do you have about how we should be talking about immunizations in a way that is respectful to folks who have gotten hold of some bad information? 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Let's go to the phones with Nancy. And Nancy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm an adult, and I've never had a problem with vaccines. And in 2015, I had a dog bite and had to get a tetanus shot, which I've never had a problem with either, and had a bad reaction to it. I was shocked. And to make matters worse, I'm right-handed. I sleep on my right side. I obviously favor my right side, and I have that's where the shot was given to me. And for almost 2 years, I had difficulty raising my arm and using my right arm. Now, I don't think too many reasonable people would be against the tetanus shot. I certainly wanted the shot, needed it. But I'm wondering, if I haven't had a problem with it before, I'm wondering if I just got a bad batch or if it's something in fillers. Because when you get a vaccine, it's not just a vaccine. It's suspended in something. And I'm questioning the fillers.
Okay, Nancy, thank you for the call. Allison Winicky, let me ask you that first. You're with the Immunization Partnership, President and CEO. I know you can't diagnose Nancy's medical issues, but you can address what's in the fillers.
Right, and so, vaccines contain different antigens to help build up a person's immunity and to protect against whatever is the vaccine is for, as well as other components, just like other prescription medications that are deemed safe by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And so they go through an extremely rigorous process where they go through clinical trials and testing, and they are deemed safe for the population at large. And then, I obviously defer to Dr. Wu and other medical professionals about, particular cases related to that and different reactions, because as we know, folks do have different reactions to medications and immunizations as medical side effects.
Right. We have genetic variation. People react differently to different things sometimes, but when we have something, it could have been anything that could cause this reaction. Dr. Wu.
It could be a reaction like you're suggesting, Nancy. It could also be that the injection was given a little higher than it should have been. So instead of getting in that muscle, some of it got in that shoulder capsule. Again, like David was saying, I don't have firsthand knowledge. But
we can't really figure out this medical issue in and of itself in this one specific example. But the things that she brings up, the issues she brings up about it, could it be a bad batch? Or could she be a outlier, genetic outlier, that this is would get a reaction that another person would not have gotten? Is it hard to say?
It's hard to say. Again, overwhelmingly, my guess is going to be that it was probably injected a little high, but
like too high of a dose.
No.
Too high
on
in
the arm instead of being here, a little bit up here, just a centimeter difference. Sometimes is probably more likely than any of those things. But we are not going to know. I'm sorry to hear that. That doesn't usually happen. So the decision to vaccinate can be complex. It can be difficult, but we know that overwhelmingly, in general, it improves the health and safety of your child and of yourself.
So I've heard that the whooping cough vaccination that I got as a child probably has worn off, or now that the disease has changed in a way, should I get a new vaccination myself?
The pertussis vaccine, which is another word for whooping cough, if you've got a new baby in your household, if you're pregnant, you should get another one. And when you go to get your tetanus vaccine every 10 years, if one of them hasn't in the last few decades been the one that's also combined with pertussis, yes, you should. That's one of the ones that the infections that is coming back. So I can tell you that, we see these little kids who cough so much, they get bruises, on their face, their eyes are all bloodshot. I mean, most kids don't die from it. The youngest ones under 6 months old, who are too young to be vaccinated, they can get pneumonia and die. But Yeah, we're seeing more pertussis, so you should
adults
look into getting vaccinated. Adults can get it too. You can cough so hard that you break a rib.
Or you can pass it along.
You can pass it along. So okay. We want the little ones protected.
Let's go to the Nicholas on the line. Nicholas, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, David. I just wanted to make the comment that I think that parents who want to opt out of giving their children these vaccinations should pay into some kind of like a state fund that is designed to insure these kids that might end up getting sick as a result. And I'll take my call at the end.
All right, Nicholas. So Allison Winicky, is that something that's being considered? Or what would be the implications?
As far as I know, that's not something that is actively under consideration. You know, as a lawyer, and one of the legal issues that, I encounter a lot with in infectious disease and public health law is that because often these diseases are spread through the air or touching or coughing and breathing, it's not like we can always pinpoint who caused exactly a person to become infected. That's why we have our epidemiologists. They do their disease tracing and try and track down sort of the origin of the disease. But once the disease gets out into the community and it spreads so quickly, everyone's impacted. And it's not like we can always go back and find out exactly who's been spreading it to who all along the way. And so that's something that it's not always as black and white when we're talking about public health about who's quote-unquote to blame for something like that. But that's why, I think that we all have the same goal. We want our children to be healthy. We want our families to be healthy. We want our communities to be healthy. And so we don't necessarily try to pin blame or a financial responsibility specifically to one person or one group, but to really make sure that folks understand that message and understand that vaccines are the safest, cheapest, and most effective way to make that happen.
Okay, let's go to another caller. This is Sam. Sam, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. My daughter was born with neonatal lupus around 19 months ago. And in one of her first rounds of vaccine, she was giving a live attenuated rotavirus vaccine. And she ended up contracting rotavirus as a result of that. And as I understand it, the rotavirus is really something that's used or needed primarily by people that are in daycare. And she's not in daycare. And I'm wondering why we're giving the same vaccine to every child, even when maybe they're not all and at the same risk.
Sam, thank you for calling in. That's a really good question. Let me go first to Dr. Wu to talk about that.
I'm sorry to hear that. And there, you can have, especially for somebody who's immune suppressed, you can have a conversation with your pediatrician. Again, my default for a lot of these is going to be talk to your pediatrician because, there are times when you would want to individuate.
But they had a medical condition.
Correct.
She had neonatal lupus.
Correct. So that's, again, we're not going to be able to get into everybody's specific situation here during this conversation.
But that was not a philosophical objection. But let me go. So let me go to Allison Winicky to talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. And I agree 100% with Dr. Wu there, is that when we have medical exemptions, obviously folks do have some medical contraindications for immunizations. And in Texas and in every state in the United States, if there are medical reasons where a physician believes that a child should not be immunized or should be immunized on a different schedule, those are always legitimate reasons because we do want to make sure that things are customized for medical reasons for the patient.
Right, and that's why we have opting out for medical reasons. We have children who have things like a leukemia or cancer, and if they do get these vaccinations, it becomes an issue. That is a legitimate concern, and there's nothing wrong with using that option. I'm really sorry about what happened with Sam and his daughter. But we need to have those conversations. We need to talk about this in a realistic way. Did you want to add to that again, Dr. Wu?
No.
Okay. All right. Another caller. Let's get Sheila on the air. Sheila, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I have a concern because I know a lot of parents who have opted out of vaccination because not related to the debunked autism study, but because there are ingredients like mercury, et cetera, in the actual vaccines themselves. And also, that a lot of these pharmaceutical companies provide in the U.S. the same vaccines that they also use, say, in Africa, and they contain a whole lot of things that kids are being inoculated against that don't necessarily apply here. And it also seems that all of the research into the safety of vaccinations seems to be funded by pharmaceutical companies. So there's an inherent, conflict of interest there, and I think that a lot of parents are concerned about those issues.
Okay. There are three things we need to tackle. One of them is about Africa, mercury, and the conflict of interest. So let's start off with the mercury part of it. When we come back from the break, we'll take on those three different components from that question that we got from Sheila. And also our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. We're having a conversation about vaccinations. You got a question, now's the time to call in. 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation today about immunizations, vaccinations, people who are opting out, some questions about the safety of vaccines. But we know they are safe, but the questions still remain. We just heard from caller Sheila. She asked a three-part question about mercury, about using the same vaccinations that we get from Africa, and also about conflict of interest in studies on these things. So let's answer Sheila's question. First of all, let's go to Dr. Junta Wu. She is with the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. And what about mercury in these vaccinations?
Most of the vaccinations, because there was this concern, at this point, don't have mercury.
So it's mercury that used to be in thimerosal.
I think it's thimerosal. But
it's taken out.
It's taken out, but there, people continue to have concerns about these low levels of other. I feel like it's the conversation that we already had about adjuvants and other things. But I'm going to also bounce that back to Allison because she was starting to answer that before we went to the break.
Okay, Allison Winicky, President and CEO of the Immunization Partnership.
Yeah, these are all really great questions. And so the caller question about mercury or thimerosal, and that is a type of mercury that we have had in vaccines prior to 2001 for in the United States. The extremely low level, it's not any more than eating, a can of tuna fish or anything like that. It's extremely low, and it's completely safe, although I think, as Dr. Wu mentioned, just to sort of, make folks feel better about, additives, we removed them for every vaccine for under the age of six back in 2001. So we don't have thimerosal in any of our infant vaccines in the United States, although it is safe at the levels, because as I mentioned earlier, the FDA approves and clears every ingredient as in vaccines as well as the vaccines as a whole as being safe and effective for the population that it is prescribed for.
Sheila's other question was about about the United States using the same vaccines that are applied in Africa. As if that is that a problem? Does that happen? Allison.
So we do hear. Obviously, there are different vaccine preventable disease issues in countries all around the world, and the vaccines that we have an issue here in the United States are not always the same that they have in other countries. For example, smallpox is eradicated. We don't have to vaccinate against that anymore, although we used to. But every country in the United States, the states, they make their own recommendations about what are the diseases that they are most at risk for in that country. And in Africa, they may have different, and they do have different risks in different African countries than we necessarily do here. I will tell you that any vaccine that is administered here in the United States to Americans here must be approved by our U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And the FDA goes and actually inspects the facilities where any vaccine given in the United States is to meet our standards only. So there's never the case where a vaccine, say, is used in a country overseas and that somehow is also used here and would not meet our standards, because it always has to meet our own FDA standards no matter where it is produced.
So saying that we're getting vaccinations that are also being used in Africa, and we're over-vaccinating our children, and that's some sort of goofy notion that got into the misinformation stream and should be discounted? I mean, can we say that, Allison Winicky?
Yes, I think that's
okay, so it's bogus.
Is absolutely
okay, I like to use direct terminology.
I don't like to make people feel
bad. I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad, but I'd like to be clear.
Yeah. So, the vaccines, I totally support what she said. They're tailored. We're not giving, like, yellow fever vaccine, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's not correct.
Okay, and the last point that she made, and I'm, you know, trying to be thorough here, about conflict of interest and funding. So, Allison Winicky, Immunization Partnership, are you funded by the pharmaceutical industry?
We have diverse funding sources from individuals, corporations, and, you know, all across the board. And so we are not exclusively funded by, you know, one industry or corporation or, you know, a group of pharmaceutical companies. You know, any sort of contributions make up a small amount of our overall portfolio.
Like Bill and Melinda Gates, they're doing a lot of funding here. They're not pharmaceutical.
Exactly. There are a lot of great health foundations, and the majority of our funding do come from other major foundations that are out there trying to improve the health and lives of Texans and the U.S. and the world at large.
Okay, Emily Royal with the Rivard Report, Data Director.
Yeah, I do want to make a point, I think, about transparency, which is something that is an interesting aspect to my work in this space as a journalist. How much of my role is going to identify and find sources of data and then excavate them and translate them into articles, stories, visuals that make sense to people so that they can understand. And I'm hearing from our callers a lot of issues about trust, trust of medical profession, trust of where our funding sources are coming from, for vaccination development. And I just want to make a point that I do feel that transparency and legibility of data and information in the space could be really important.
Right. And so transparency is important, just as you have the data showing that we have more local schools showing kids not getting vaccinated.
And that's public data. I think that the trick is, you know, finding the time and having the skills to interpret it.
Let's go to another caller. This is Diana. Diana, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll just briefly say that my basic question concerns why are not more steps being taken to determine the factors which might predispose a child to a reaction. I have two children. One of them reacted to two of his vaccines. But when he was all well and it was all done, I took him to a pediatric allergist and asked for him to be tested for any underlying conditions. And they found that his histamine level on a normal day when he was not sick was 3 times normal. So I always wondered, and the allergist said that it was possible that he overreacted because of that. Are any steps being taken to determine factors that predispose certain children to bad reactions?
All right. Thank you for the call. I appreciate that, Diana. Let's go to Dr. Junda Wu.
And I'm going to say, we don't get any money from pharmaceutical companies, and I totally understand why people have that concern about pharma, and I do too, and I think, like Emily said, transparency is the key. So I don't know if any of us on this call, maybe I more than anyone knows, but all I can say is there's no commercial test available and cheap that would provide that information, but I don't know what research is being done.
Okay, another caller. This is Owen. Owen, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to make a comment. When I was in grade school, this was 50-some years ago, we had a day where we all sat down and we took a polio vaccine in a little cup with a sugar cube, and it completely eradicated polio across the United States. Now, this was in the early 50s. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right, so we no longer have to buy iron lungs in bulk for communities. That's what the city of San Antonio used to do because polio outbreaks. It was something that would devastate entire cities at a time. Allison Winicky, polio is no longer a thing, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And same with, you know, polio is not an issue here in the United States, although there are still a couple of countries where we are trying to make that very last push to eradicate it. You know, something that is that I really like to emphasize about immunizations is that eradication is our ultimate goal. The goal is to make sure that everyone is immunized so that the infectious agent out there dies. There is no way to transmit it from person to person. And then eventually, you know, we don't have to take the polio vaccine anymore. We wouldn't have to take these other vaccines anymore because we have been able, through vaccines, to eradicate these deadly diseases from our natural environment.
And Allison, quickly, I know that having these types of conversations on the radio, as we talk about how important it is to get vaccinated and how there is no connection between a vaccine and autism, it has the opposite effect. It actually leads people to doubt the actual information and gives a higher probability that a parent is going to make the decision to opt out. I mean, how do we combat the fact that here we are presenting solid information telling people to get vaccinations, and it's a boomerang effect?
Well, vaccines are here to protect ourselves, our family, and the public's health. I know folks have a lot of questions, and it's important that they get addressed. Even the question about pharma's financial incentives, you know, really when you look at their portfolio, pharma doesn't even make that much money on vaccines.
They'd make a lot more money if there weren't vaccines.
Well, exactly. I mean, I believe pharma makes a lot more money on sort of the chronic long-term diseases, and it's only about 1 or 2% of all of their income comes from vaccines. So vaccines aren't a moneymaker. Vaccines are here for the public to protect us, and that's why that they are so important.
All right. I want to thank Allison Winicky for joining us this afternoon. She's the president and CEO of the Immunization Partnership. Dr. Junda Wu is the medical director for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. Emily Royal is with us. She's the data director for the Rivard Report. She did a deep dive looking at where in San Antonio, what schools are having the highest rate of opting out. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.